In the name of one God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer of our lives, amen. Please be seated. We're doing two things today. We're celebrating Epiphany, and we're celebrating a wedding. And somehow I have to join those two together and make them make sense. I don't know how possible that is, other than to say part of what we're doing here, part of what we do as a community of faith is that we are people who follow the road of hope. If you can say nothing else about what it means to be people of faith, it is that. People of faith are people who live in hope. And this particular community tells a particular story. We're people who have joined ourselves to this ongoing story that's being told from generation to generation to generation that extends back thousands of years, and somehow this community of faith unites itself to that particular story, and somehow weave the stories of our lives into that story, that larger story. And so that's what we are doing here today. We're remembering that we are people who trod the road of hope, and that our lives are woven into this larger story. To understand the story that I just read, which I think we have domesticated and misunderstood, and so I will give my critique of that, and critique that awful hymn that we just sung, but we sing because we do it every year, again and again, because that's what we do, it's tradition, we do it, but it's wrong. So I'll talk about that. But to understand, I think, what's going on, I want to go back to these texts that we read, these ancient texts. This first one from Isaiah, which predates the birth of Jesus by, you know, at least 500 years. And the hope that this text takes and states for people who have just been in captivity. These are people who have lived in bondage in a foreign country for generation upon generation, and have now returned home. And they had great hope that things would be different in this new home, and yet they realize that, the realities of life are still there. I mean, even if you've come to the place where you've journeyed, you still have to deal with the realities of your life. Wherever you go, you take yourself with you. And this is the message the prophet says to them. The prophet says to them, arise. Arise and shine, for your light has come. And the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For darkness shall cover the earth. You are in darkness. You know darkness. There's been a thick darkness on the peoples. But the Lord will rise upon you, and his glory will appear over you. Like, do you hear the hope that is there? Even in the midst of darkness, there is this sense that no, light will come. There will be a rising, and it will dawn upon you, and you will be radiant, and your heart shall thrill and rejoice. And then it talks about the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you, and the wealth of nations will come to you. A multitude of camels will cover you. Young camels from Midian, Ephah, and those from Sheba shall come, and they shall bring gold and frankincense, and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord. So already there's this sense among the people of God in this story that God's people tell amongst themselves that somehow as we're waiting in this darkness for the light to shine and the coming of the light, that something new will happen. Something unexpected will happen that will be extraordinary and astonishing and genuinely surprise us. And people from all over will come to it, from Midian and Ephah and Sheba, and they shall bring the gift of kings, right? That's Isaiah. Then you have this psalm that we read. These songs, psalms were songs that were sung. This is probably a coronation psalm for a king, and expresses the hope that a people have for what a king might be like. Because the reality is, and too often, when you have kings and queens and you put particular people in power, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And what we hope for from our leaders always ends up then being disappointing and disappointing us, because our leaders often then use their power for their own self-aggrandizement. Or our leaders often use power in a way that doesn't care for the common good or care for those who are really in need of healing and justice. Our leaders are often perpetuators of injustice. So that's what's astonishing about this psalm. The psalm is actually offering a different paradigm from what humans normally do, what leaders normally do, what kings and queens normally do. It says, give the king your justice, O God, your righteousness. May this individual see things as you do rather than as the world does. May he rule your people righteously, in a right way, in a good way, and the poor with justice. He shall defend the needy among the people. He shall rescue the poor and crush the oppressor. He shall live as long as the sun and moon, and he shall come down like rain, like showers that water the earth, so that there will be flourishing in the land. The rulers of Tarshish and the Isles shall pay tribute, and the rulers of Arabia and Saba will offer gifts. That these kings from other places will be so astonished by this king that they will come and offer gifts. Right? That is, that the world will see this king and be so surprised that they will come and offer gifts. All nations shall bow before him. All nations do him service, for he shall deliver the poor who cries out in distress, and the oppressor who has no help. He shall have pity on the lowly and poor. He shall preserve the lives of the needy. He shall redeem their lives from oppression and violence. Dear shall their blood be in his sight. This form of authority will preserve and value the blood of the people and not shed it. Right? And not expend it in the ways that kings and queens and tyrants and dictators and authoritarians often do, because they really don't care about the people. They only care about themselves. And so this vision that's being offered is one of a different paradigm, and it's this hope that the people of God have carried, that somehow this kind of rule, somehow this kind of authority can manifest itself in our lives, and in our places, and in our countries, and in our nations. This again, I mean, these are the documents, these are the testimonies that the people of God, who are the part of the story that we're a part of, this is their hope that they've tried to keep alive for centuries. And that's what we do as people of faith. We long for and desire rulers, leaders, that actually will do right, that actually will be just, that actually will care about the weakest among us, that actually will defend the rights of the poor and not exploit them. That's part of our tradition. That's the hope that the people of God, the Jewish people specifically had, because these are Jewish texts, that's their hope. And that's where this story today begins, like this story that I just read. But, I mean, first we sang that hymn about we three kings of Orient are. Like, it's just wrong and misguided, right? For lots of different reasons. But partially because, we no longer refer to, you know, peoples of different countries in the way that we talk about the Orient, right? I mean, there was a, I mean, it's just, we don't do that anymore. But the notion that there were kings, or the notion that there were three of them. The text doesn't say that there were three. Nor does the text say that they were kings. The text said there are three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Right? That's what there are three of, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And the tradition, our tradition in the West, has been to say that there are three of them. You know, in East, they have 12. Like, how they got 12, I don't know. But you go to the Syrian Orthodox Church, and they've got 12 of them rather than three. But we ended up with three. Text doesn't say three. Text doesn't say they're male. Text doesn't say they're female. What the text says, nor does it say that they're kings. The text says they are magi. What a magi was in the ancient world was a Zoroastrian priest. It was an astrologer, an astronomer from Persia. That's who these folks are. They're astrologers and astronomers from Persia who do horoscopes. Right? You can see why we've domesticated this text, and that doesn't sell well, very well, right? I mean, what are astrologers and these astrologers who do horoscopes doing looking for a Jewish king, right? It's very troubling. What are these people who actually, I mean, they're Zoroastrian. Zoroastrianism predates Christianity, and nobody's sure exactly how old it is, but it's an ancient religion. It predates, it's monotheistic. It's one of the monotheistic faiths. Along with Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, Zoroastrianism. They believe in one God. They believe that there is the divine is singular in a way at the heart of all reality. And these astronomers, who are Zoroastrian priests, are looking up into the sky with a sense of longing, right? They're individuals who are looking up into the heavens, wanting to discern what the divine is up to. And that's what you're doing when you're trying to make sense of this world, you're trying to make sense of this life. And here these priests are, they say that maybe there's something about the way the heavens are playing out that can help us understand our own lives in a very real way. That's what these folks are doing. They're people who are longing, and they're people who also have hope. Like, they're living in the hope that somehow the divine might be up to something that will surprise us and interest us. That somehow the divine actually may be interesting, and they want to be a part of it. And so they're reading the stars, right? And they're looking, you know, what planets are in what constellations, and I don't even know the terms in terms of, you know, what's rising and declining and all those things, but they're trying to assess these things, and somehow they discern that in Israel there's going to be a king. Right? And, you know, the world's a big place. I'm sure there are lots of kings being born. It would make sense if they were going to go, if there was a Roman emperor that was being born, or an Egyptian pharaoh that was being born, or even a Chinese, ruler, monarch that was being born. They don't journey in any of those directions. Those stars apparently don't compel them. For whatever reason, they're drawn to Israel. To this king. They're drawn to this paradigm, this alternate paradigm, because I think they are drawn to hope. Because it's a long journey. If you're in Persia, which is modern-day Iran, to make this journey to Bethlehem or to Jerusalem would take you weeks, if not months. It's a long journey to make. There's an entourage. We don't know how many of them there are. There's probably a group of men and women that are traveling together to make this journey. And they're bringing gifts. And they're doing it, I mean, not because they're trying to make a political alliance or gain economic, gain some sort of economic advantage for themselves. They're doing it to pay homage, for whatever reason, to this king who represents this different paradigm. And so they make this journey to Jerusalem to meet with the current king, Herod the Great, and ask, where is the new king of the Jews? Now, Herod thought that he was the king of the Jews, right? So this is a problematic introduction for him, right? Herod the Great, he's called Herod the Great because he built a lot of stuff that, you know, still exists. Masada and in Judaism, if you've ever been in Jerusalem, where Jews now, the holiest part is the Western Wall, which is the remaining of the foundation of the Second Temple that Herod the Great built, actually. Those big stones that you see in those pictures are what's left of Herod's temple. But the man was a tyrant. He wasn't great. He wasn't a good ruler in the ways that the people of God had longed for a good ruler, for a ruler who would defend the poor, for a ruler who would kind of take care of those of the common good. No, he was a tyrant. He murdered one of his wives. He murdered his children. Yes, he wasn't a good guy, right? It is messed up. Thank you. Good. Glad that somebody recognizes it. It's messed up. This guy was messed up, and yet he was their king, right? And so these followers of a different religion, these strangers to Israel, these people who would have been unclean, these astrologers who do horoscopes, somehow make their way, and they are interjected into the story of God. Right? That's part of what's astonishing, that these folks are interjected into the story of God and become an important part of the story of God and the story of God's people. Of course, they show up and they say, show us this new king. And Herod, what the text says is that Herod is afraid. And you have to remember that fear is a spiritual condition, and not the right kind of spiritual condition. Because when Herod is afraid, then all of Jerusalem is afraid. And the people now are driven by fear rather than hope. And that's the problem. When you're driven by fear rather than hope, you've lost your way. You need stars to guide you back. And so here the people are, living in fear, because Herod, the ruler, is afraid of what God might do. So he calls his scribes and his Pharisees and, like, give me the prophecy. Where is the Messiah going to be born? Where is this king going to be born? And they reference the book of Micah, and they're like, in Bethlehem. It says Bethlehem, even though this particular tribe, the tribe was the least of the tribes, it's going to be born in Bethlehem. That's where there will be a true shepherd for the people of Israel. A true king, a king who will follow this paradigm that we hope for. And so Herod says to this group of magi, this group of astrologers, hey, go and look for him. Tell me where he's at, because I would like to pay homage to him, which he doesn't want to do. He wants to kill him. He wants to kill him. He wants to eradicate him. That's the kind of guy this guy is. He will kill children. They go, they follow this star, and they find this baby. And it's just a baby in a very humble setting with nothing too astounding to recommend it. And that somehow gives them joy. That somehow has made the trip worth it. That somehow they've discovered this different road, this different paradigm, and they give this baby gifts fit for a king of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And then they're warned by God not to go back to Herod. And so they go back to their own country by another road. And I don't know what happens. We don't know what happens. We don't know what happens to these astrologers who go back. But somehow they do go back with joy. And somehow they found hope and become part of God's story. Story continues. What we didn't read is that Joseph is told in a dream that the child, his child, his son, is in danger, and so they flee to Egypt. And then Herod, when he knows that he's been duped or that he hasn't gotten what he wanted, he orders all the male children under 2 years old in Bethlehem to be slaughtered. That's the kind of king that he is. He kills all those children. Right? That's at the center of this story. We don't read that part. We feel that part is a little bit too dark for a Sunday morning or the day of a wedding. But I think we need to grapple with the realities of that, because you don't understand the hope that these people live in unless you understand that was the reality of the world they lived in. Kings and rulers did that sort of thing, and they're hoping for a different way. There is no good segue now to talk about a wedding. So we're going to have a rough movement over to the wedding. Other than living as people in hope, right? And living as people who have put our story into God's story, right? That's what you two have chosen to do, right? Many of you are wondering, okay, here we have two people within our community who want to get married, and they're getting married in a Sunday morning service. What's up with that? Like, why would we do that? And I think it's most right and appropriate. The reason why we would do that is because we are Julie and David's spiritual family. We are their community, right? We have been with them in their previous marriages, right? We were there. We knew Dick, right? We knew Susie. We knew Julie and Dick together, and we knew David and Susie together, and we celebrated their lives, and we were there when Dick died, and we were there when Susie died, and we've been with them on this journey together. And now here we are, these two who we hold dear. They're part of, their story is now part of our story, which is why we're here. But they've felt it really important to say that their story is also part of this larger story, this community that we are, that we come together as people who live in hope, right? There is nothing more hopeful than getting married when you're in your late 70s and early 80s. Seriously, right? That is profoundly hopeful, and it has been such a gift for me. I did the premarital counseling sessions with them, right? And I was blessed. It was such a blessing for me to be there and to be present as I experienced the love that they share for each other at this late date, right? That it's still possible. Like, oh my God, that's great. That's amazing, right? So it's a blessing for me, and I think it's a blessing for us as a community to be able to be present with them and for them. And so Julie was like, hey, can we just do like something during the birthdays and anniversaries? Can we just like somehow get married during the birthdays and anniversaries? And I'm like, well, we could probably do more than that. Because we do believe, actually, as a community of faith, given our Episcopal tradition, like, we still do have this sense that somehow, some way, marriage is a sacrament. That somehow, some way, God works in and through, the Spirit of God works in and through this thing that helps us grow deeper into grace, that helps us grow deeper into love. And that somehow, we do this in the context that this is not just a contract between two people, that somehow this is also something that the heavens themselves are concerned with. And that the angels today might be rejoicing. That's what it means for this to be a sacrament. That somehow today, even the angels themselves are rejoicing.